This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Really, it's just a question of which big economic issue you want to start with today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today. This one is the 2nd of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So, what do you think? Banks, right? I mean, we could start with the debt limit or the Fed meeting tomorrow, but honestly, banks are and will be until Wall Street starts taking that debt limit risk seriously. Banks are the through line of this economy right now. The hope, of course, is that the worst of the banking situation is behind us. But as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, the banking industry is already looking a little bit different than it did just a couple of months ago.
For one, the banking system is more fragile. Stephen Kelly with the Yale Program on Financial Stability says a lot of people are nervous about their deposits, even if their banks are actually doing fine.
It's just always easier, you know, as an individual to run on a bank and figure out the truth later.
Kelly says the banking system is likely to become more regulated, at least when it comes to mid-sized banks, like the ones that failed. Chris Odenay, a law professor at the University of Iowa, says there's also a risk that the industry will become more consolidated if more banks fail.
If that's the case, then of course that creates more opportunities for large banks to acquire these banks, or at least acquire their assets.
This is all happening at a time when banks are pulling back on lending, which is part of the goal of the Federal Reserve's interest rate hikes. If the sector gets more concentrated, Odenay says newer businesses will have an even harder time getting loans. That's because bigger national banks tend to favor established businesses that have a history of paying back their debt.
Making that determination for a newer business requires much more people time. It's more hands-on. That's harder to automate.
Another side effect of bank consolidation, banks tend to close branches, says Marisa Baradaran, a law professor at UC Irvine.
So you're going to have many, many communities that don't have a bank within, you know, 50 miles or something. That's a devastating thing for thriving businesses in that community.
Baradaran says over the last 10 years, more than 95% of merger-related branch closures were in lower-income and rural communities. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
As J.P. Morgan starts to digest First Republic after the takeover early yesterday morning, there are some threads to pull on what exactly JPM got for its money. A big chunk of First Republic's loan portfolio were interest-only mortgages, where, just like it sounds, for a set period of time, the borrower pays the interest only before starting to chip away at the principal. These kinds of mortgages were big in the lead-up to the financial crisis back in 2008, and as Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports, 15 years later, they are still not without risk.
Some interest-only mortgages allow borrowers to go up to 10 years without putting any money towards the principal. But interest rates can change, and Danielle Hale, chief economist at Realtor.com, says that variable cost, combined with the principal you do eventually have to pay back, can cause what's known as payment shock.
There is this future state where even if rates go down, you may still potentially face higher monthly payments.
Back in 2006, interest-only loans accounted for more than a third of all new mortgages, estimates Guy Sakala of the research firm Inside Mortgage Finance. After the housing crisis and recession that followed, the government introduced restrictions around who could get this kind of loan.
interest-only mortgages generally are only available to people with high incomes, large down payments, strong credit scores, the wealthy, in a nutshell.
But even when borrowers are wealthy, these debts can cause problems for lenders, especially if the banks are locked into low interest rates on the loans while money is getting more expensive for them to borrow. This is what's known as an interest rate mismatch. And Sakala says First Republic had to deal with that.
So they had to borrow money at 5% when they were only getting 3.5% or 3% on most of the loans on their books.
Sakala's firm estimates First Republic was the country's biggest originator of interest-only mortgages last year. But Daniel Hale at Realtor.com says they're likely to become more of a niche product, especially as lenders see the problems they're causing now. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not great. Mostly banking agita, maybe a teensy bit of debt limit thrown in there as well. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Federal Open Market Committee has finished day one of its two-day interest rate meeting. Rate announcement and Fed Chair Jay Powell press conference coming tomorrow. But as the committee sat down this morning, it got one last piece of data to chew on. The March job openings and labor turnover survey from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which brought with it another sign of a gradually cooling labor market. The number of job openings is still high. Yes, almost 9.6 million. But March was the third straight month it has gone down. And meanwhile, the number of people quitting their jobs fell just a bit, and layoffs were up slightly. On the Hey, Can You Sort This All Out For Us desk today is Marketplace's Savannah Marr.
In a labor market with lots of job openings and not a lot of job seekers, employers have to raise pay. That's great for individual workers, not always great for the economy at large, says Wendy Edelberg with the Brookings Institution.
If the only reason that they're paying higher wages is to entice people to take jobs, that's an input cost rising that they're going to have to pass along through higher prices.
Higher pay eventually means higher costs for all of us. Edelberg says that's why you can't tame inflation without taming the red-hot pandemic job market. And after lots of up and down jobs data,
job openings are just falling like a rock.
Big picture. Churning in the labor market is beginning to calm down.
Peter Phillips, a labor economist at the University of Utah, says sectors that boomed in 2022, like retail and hospitality, are now slowing down hiring. Workers are a little less inclined to quit their jobs, but we're also not seeing mass layoffs.
It sort of has some of the flavor of a soft landing from the turmoil and the volatility of the pandemic.
For the labor market, at least, these are signs that the Fed's rate hikes are finally doing what they're supposed to, says University of Michigan professor Betsy Stevenson.
Their policy choices often have lagged effects. So we're likely to see the labor market continue to tighten over the next few months.
Stevenson says things are moving in the direction the Fed wants, just not as quickly as it wants. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Teva sandals, Coach bags, Crocs, and Abercrombie & Fitch. Anybody see a pattern there? If you're thinking brands that were big 15 or 20 years ago and that are now back in fashion, go straight to the head of the class. Admittedly, these comebacks seem kind of random, a stroke of luck or surge of nostalgia, perhaps. But as Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports, a whole lot of work goes into making a brand big again.
It was the year 2006, smack dab in the middle of the early aughts, and Birkenstock was losing its foothold as everyone's favorite ugly shoe. So it brought in some outsiders to take stock of its products. Consultant Eric Jochumstaller visited the U.S. headquarters in California, and he was shocked at what he saw.
I remember there was this one wall of all the shoes, and they had some amazing designs.
In all different colors, materials, and styles.
But neither the retailers where the image is created nor the journalists that write about the fashion in shoes would actually feature anything but the two straps and three straps.
The brand's Arizona sandal was its best seller. It had, for better and then worse, become the company's identity.
We needed to change the brand from not being just about that iconic model, but really show the breadth of products they had.
Joachim Stoller came up with an incentive to push other designs, give people on the sales team a bigger commission when they sell newer models.
And don't talk about the two straps. And don't talk about the hippies. And I know you are a hippie because you've been here for 30 years. Let me tell you what you need to tell to the specialty stores when you're trying to sell.
Fast forward a handful of years, and Birkenstock overcame its crunchy granola image. Vogue staffers wrote stories gushing about them. And the designer brand Celine featured copycat styles at Paris Fashion Week. Today, Birkenstocks are still cool. And I know what some of you must be thinking. This is just some Y2K stuff that's back in style. But Luke Williams, author of Disrupt, Think the Unthinkable to Spark Transformation in Your Business, says companies can't rely on nostalgia alone. Think of all the brands that never came back into style.
Take your pick, Kodak and Polaroid in digital photography, or BlackBerry or Blockbuster. We never think this is going to happen to us.
He says when brands are super strong, when they're associated with one image or product, they can get tunnel vision.
And I guarantee if 98% of a brand's revenue is coming from one particular product, 98% of everyone's attention is going into maintaining that product. And this is why we see so many brands become irrelevant overnight.
Irrelevant because another company comes in and disrupts the market. Take BlackBerry. Remember when the coolest way to text was BBM? And now it's Blue Bubble or Bust? But some brands with aging images have made stunning comebacks. Abercrombie & Fitch, Pabst Blue Ribbon, Casio Watches. They revamped their products or tweaked their marketing. They turned over their C-suites. Victoria's Secret is doing all of the above. A handful of years ago, it was losing ground to American Eagle and Savage Fenty, and it had a big image problem. Its former CEO had ties to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Net sales fell by more than $500 million in 2019. Sarah Sylvester is Executive Vice President of Marketing.
The old Victoria's Secret definitely felt like it was more about women through a male's gaze and us saying, like, this is what sexy is. And I think with the new Victoria's Secret, it's what she defines as sexy and glamorous.
Victoria's Secret stores have been redesigned from dark and stark to light and airy. Its models are more diverse and its undergarments have become more practical.
How can we not sell, you know, mastectomy or maternity bras? Like, why would we turn any woman away for anything that she needs if we're supposed to be the leader in bras?
Sylvester expects the rebrand to take 5 years, which puts Victoria's Secret about halfway through its journey. And it'll take this long because when lots of customers hear Victoria's Secret, they still think of thin models in rhinestone bras and angel wings.
Which is amazing, maybe except when you're trying to do a rebrand and change that perception.
It's hoping to cement that image change with its iconic marketing event. The Victoria's Secret Fashion Show is coming back this year after a 4-year hiatus. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up,
99% of all the pictures I take of my daughter are on film.
Like Kristen said, what is old can be cool again. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 367 today, 1.1% finished at 33,684. The NASDAQ gave up 132 points, 1.1%, 12,080. The S&P 500 down 48, just shy of 1.2%. Ended things at 41.19. The collapse of First Republic revived fears of contagion in the banking sector. Comerica slid 12.4%. PacWest Bancorp down almost 28%. The KBW Bank Index, which tracks publicly traded banks and thrifts in the United States, hit its lowest point in a year and closed down 4.5%. Going the other way, Uber Technologies reported after 2 years of pretty meh performance. It's growing again. Shares ascended 11.5%. Bonds up as well. Yield on the 10-year T-note down though 3.43%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Now that there's a much more real deadline for the debt limit, June the 1st, quite possibly, is what Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said yesterday. What Republicans in the House are looking for in return for not refusing to pay our debt already accumulated becomes a bit more real as well. One of Speaker McCarthy's key demands is more and more strict work requirements for government welfare programs, from Medicaid to food stamps to cash welfare. The idea of work requirements, contrary to the way it's being presented, is nothing new. Some government benefit programs have had work requirements for decades, among them temporary assistance for needy families, more commonly known as cash welfare. Also not new is confusion about how those work requirements work. The new season of our podcast, The Uncertain Hour, is an examination of exactly that. Here's Marketplace's Chrissy Clark.
When Darnetta Harris was in her late 20s and living in Chicago, an ex-boyfriend beat her so badly, she ended up in the hospital. She fled to Milwaukee with her son and daughter, broke and alone. As she tried to get her life back together, she was referred to a local welfare office. Her first priority?
I can't just sit here and expect for somebody to take care of me. I need a job.
Since the 1990s, most people receiving cash welfare have to fulfill certain work requirements in order to get a monthly check. And the idea that welfare was all about work, that sounded great to Darnetta.
If you can give me a lead somewhere, then I can try to make it work the best for me.
Darnetta already had a lot of work experience, a solid resume, was close to completing an associate's degree. She wanted to become an addiction counselor and already had some certifications under her belt. But when she went to the welfare office, the caseworker didn't seem interested in all that. Instead, she immediately assigned Darnetta to start working at a local food bank.
She gave me a description of the job and stocked boxes and this, that.
Just stacking boxes, like you would have just been doing kind of manual labor, basically.
Right.
Oh, and also, her case manager explained, this wouldn't be an actual paying job. It was unpaid labor. The idea being it would give her basic job skills. But for that work, she'd essentially be earning less than the equivalent of minimum wage. And Darnetta felt like she already had plenty of job skills.
I'm like, no, I actually just told the work I can't do that.
Darnetta soon learned that fulfilling work requirements does not mean actually having a family-supporting job. It means engaging in a list of 12 federally approved, quote, work activities.
A paying job will qualify. But if you don't have one of those yet, you're assigned to 30 or 40 hours a week of other activities, like searching for jobs, taking motivational job readiness classes, or doing unpaid work experience, like that labor Darnetta was assigned at the food bank. You also have to document each hour of work activity that you do, with extensive logs and timesheets. After Darnetta protested about the box packing work, she got assigned to work experience in an office. But as she tried to comply with all her work requirements, she says they didn't feel like they were doing much to help her find a job that would lift her family out of poverty. And meanwhile, she and her family were still dealing with the aftermath of the domestic violence that had brought her to the welfare office in the first place.
I have to take my son to this therapy. I have to go to parenting class. I have to go to family therapy.
But these very important things that Darnetta was doing to try to heal her family, they started getting in the way of her required work activities. And when she missed even an hour of an activity, her check could get docked. She says one check was reduced from more than $600 to just $400. The electric company was threatening to cut off her lights. Darnetta felt like the system was more concerned with monitoring and sanctioning her work activities than getting her the help she needed. And the reason behind that focus goes back to the way welfare work requirements have been laid out in federal law. Because they aren't actually about work. The law really only focuses on one thing.
The work participation rate.
The work participation rate.
Or WPR.
This is Jeanette Holdbrook with Mathematica, the nonpartisan public policy research group. She consults with state and local welfare offices across the country. And she says the work participation rate is a measure of how many people receiving temporary assistance for needy families, or TANF, are doing the required amount of those 12 federally mandated work activities.
It doesn't tell you how many people got jobs. It doesn't tell you how many people no longer need to receive TANF benefits. All it tells you is of the families who can be participating in work activities, how many are participating in work activities.
And that's why Darnetta was sanctioned for missing work activities. Because when someone on welfare does less than the hours they're supposed to do, that can bring down the work participation rate. States are judged on that one metric and can lose federal dollars if it falls too low. Jeanette says she's seen programs where supervisors spent a lot of time worried about these numbers.
Let's look at who has work activities. Let's look at who doesn't have work activities. You have no time left to actually have conversations with people or help people build skills or help get them connected to mental health supports, housing.
And Jeanette says 20 years of careful studies of compliance-based work requirement programs show.
Broadly, that hasn't been an approach that has gotten people into family-sustaining wage jobs.
As for Darnetta Harris, she did eventually get a job, one she found herself, not from a lead provided by the welfare office. And looking back on her time with the work requirements of cash welfare, she says they felt more like busy work and paperwork requirements, instead of things that actually helped her get sustainable work. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Believe me when I tell you, you want to hear the whole new season of The Uncertain Hour on welfare and work. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts. As we've talked about a bunch of times, the pandemic changed a whole lot of things. It changed how and where a lot of us worked. It changed what we spent our money on. And it changed how we spend our time. To those for whom photography is a hobby, one word, film. 35mm and disposable film cameras are often in favor now over smartphones. But the film itself and film developing equipment can be hard to find. And even when they are in stock, the prices just keep going up. That is the setup for today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is David Montejano. I am in Los Angeles, California, and I am a photographer and part-time TikToker, I guess. That's the best way to put it. I had been shooting digital for years, and I just really wanted like an extra challenge. Digital had become not so much easy, but it was kind of mundane, and you know, I was doing it for work. So film definitely added a challenge and also nostalgia for me. I love film photography. It's like my passion. That's what I love, to not only shoot the most, but also like talk about the most. TikTok just allows me to share this with everybody, like, and also meet all kinds of people. So it's really fun to like just talk about film photography. I noticed film photography getting more popular definitely around like 2019 into like 2020 and the pandemic. Everyone was just home and they just all took up photography, or specifically film photography. That's definitely when I just saw a rise in like people just all over social media. Just all of a sudden, it seemed like everyone was shooting film. But also, I also noticed the prices of everything just started going up. You know, these 50-year-old cameras, the actual film stocks themselves, like prices just kind of went up with the popularity. The prices have become kind of daunting for a first timer. Before, a roll of film costs like $5. Now these stocks are going into like $14, $20. And it's definitely something to think about. It's gotten to a point where I'm hearing more and more that folks don't want to try it because it's become financially just like a little scary to try for the first time and maybe not even get the results you want. You know, I'm a millennial, so all my pictures are from as a kid are from the 80s and 90s. So all of my memories are of film pictures. So it's kind of nice to have that now that I'm a dad and I have a daughter, and 99% of all the pictures I take of my daughter are on film. That's really why I love starting to shoot it and why I continue to love shooting it. Like, I can, you know, share that experience with the next generation, which is my daughter.
That's David Montejano. He's a film photographer and a TikToker right here in Los Angeles. You know, we cannot do this series without knowing what's going on with you. So tell us, would you, at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, in which we stay with banking, tip of the hat here to one-time Marketplace reporter David Gura, who now works for that other public radio company. Anyway, Gura pointed out on Twitter this morning that the three banks that have failed so far this year had $552 billion in assets. Three banks, $552 billion in assets. Back in 2008, when 25 banks went under, total assets then, $364 billion. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. It's courtesy of a new survey from J.D. Power. The percentage of Americans who say they are very unlikely to buy an EV the next time they need a new car is up. 17.8% very unlikely in January, 21% very unlikely in March. Those very likely to go electric, full disclosure here, I'm a brand new EV guy, got rid of the minivan. Anyway, very likely, steady at almost 27%. Digital and on demand around here. Carrie Barber, Dylan Mieth, and Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is in charge over there. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.